This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina and the Florence County Museum, presenting Edward Gay, an American landscape painter, chronicling Gay's evolving style amid the turn of the 20th century and his unique connections to South Carolina and the National Academy of Design, now through February 23rd. flococomuseum.org. And Meadow Garden, home of George Walton, one of the youngest signers of the Declaration of Independence. Open for tours Monday through Friday, 10 to 4. Learn more at historicmeadowgarden.org and visit augusta.com.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history, with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with Dr. Judith Bainbridge about her book, A Short History of Greenville.
The book is a concise and engaging history that traces Greenville's development from backcountry settlement to one of America's best small cities.
In this lively historical account, Judith Bainbridge invites readers to explore the full expanse of Greenville's history, from its earliest days as Cherokee hunting grounds to its development as a Western outpost settlement and later a 19th century summer resort. My first question to you, Judy, is why is an English professor writing a history of Greenville?
And the answer, Walter, is because I got interested and because a writer has to write. I've always written, sometimes for newspapers, sometimes scholarly articles. But in 1999, the Greenville News called and asked me, please, to do an article on Greenville history for their city people. So starting in 1999 with a pretty short article on Shoeless Joe Jackson, who started at Brandon Mills. And that was the first one, and it was so much fun to do. So over the years, I had an awful lot of articles, two a month, basically, every other week, for 22 years on Greenville history, bits and pieces here and there. But after the University of South Carolina Press called and asked me to do the article, to do a book, A Short History, which was to build, you understand, on A.V. Huff's long history. And his is definitive. But a short history that I could use so much of what I'd already written. And so it took me about 8 months to do it. But the other thing, Walter, that is almost as perhaps as strange as an English professor writing a short history is the fact that I'm a Yankee.
Oh, good heavens! But then a lot of people who helped make Greenville, particularly in the 20th century, came from off as well. So,
yes.
But you were long enough and rubbing shoulders, literally, with A.V. Huff as your colleague. That you're okay. We'll take you.
Yeah.
Well, it has been more than 40 years, so hey, I think I qualify.
Well, I must say that your book, I like the way you wrote it. I like the way you had it illustrated. And for someone who wants to get a quick view of Greenville, it's wonderful. You had a way with words. And I'm going to mention three of the chapters, and we're going to talk about those because we don't have time to talk about the whole book. The first would be Building the Textile Crescent, 1870 to 1900, which is, of course, the beginnings of how Greenville became the most important textile town in the country in the early 20th century. Reinventing Greenville, 1970 to 1995, and that's the time period that I was here in South Carolina and watched that transformation of Greenville. I can remember living here in Columbia, and that's when we still just had banks that were state located within the state. And there were bankers who were either from the Low Country or Columbia getting assigned to Greenville was considered being assigned to Hades. I mean, who on earth wants to live in Greenville, South Carolina? I mean,
it was an ugly town. There was no question.
Highlighted by the Technicolor Reedy River, which ran different colors and had a certain odor about it most of the time. And why was that? I mean, I remember it. I mean, it was an open sewer.
Purple, blue, green. It depended upon what the dyeing and bleaching operations were dyeing and bleaching on any given day. And so you had Renfrew Bleachery in Traveler's Rest and Union Bleachery just outside of Greenville. And they were right on the river, and it came right down into the middle of town and then went on its way. It was covered by a bridge, the Reedy River was, of course, which had buildings on either side of it, but particularly on the right-hand side. It was 3 years after I moved to Greenville that I realized there was a river. Nobody paid any attention to it. But by 1978, they started to, thanks to Max Heller.
Okay. Who was the mayor at the time?
Was the mayor. And so, that's the part of the chapter of reinventing Greenville that really begins with Max Heller's term. Yeah. But let's go back to building the textile mills, because if you know contemporary history of the 20th century, Greenville became the textile city, but building the textile crescent refers to those mills that were built kind of around Greenville, correct?
Right. The Western Crescent, which blocked expansion later to the all the way from the west is always to the east. But those mills were almost, in some cases, almost touching. The proximity between Dunneen and Mills Mill, between Dunneen and Judson, between Judson and Woodside. At Woodside, Union Bleachery is a little off. But there were all of these mills and all of the mill villages surrounding them, which created a whole new world in Greenville between 1897, about when American spinning opened, and then into the 20th century, well into the 20th century, and in the 1920s, when Greenville boomed for the first time, or really boomed. At that point, there were a great many more, seven more mills built in the 1920s, and that sort of cemented this strong crescent around the town itself.
Well,
it was a fascinating time.
You mentioned the mill village. That's part of the story. And another town, when it began to get textile mills, Greenwood, the local newspaper made the comment, "With these mill workers, we now have a caste within our class." You touched on earlier about the mills really did make a change and brought a class structure to Greenville that had not existed before.
Yes, exactly. It made haves and have-nots. The have-nots lived in the village. The haves lived mostly in Boyce Lawn. 16 mill owners by 1915 or so. And they were rich, Walter. They were well-to-do. They were just plain stinking rich. And they enjoyed every moment of it. They built mega mansions. Well, real mansions. I don't know whether mega is exactly the right word. But for the time, they were quite extraordinary.
And we're talking about they were able, a well-run one, I believe you mentioned, could earn up to 20% return on investment a year.
Yeah, well, this changes over time, you should understand. Particularly in the early days, yes, no question about it. Camperdown Mill, Piedmont Mill, this is both in 1876, before the real surge after the economic depression in 1893, things had been bad for a while, but more cash was coming into town. There are now three banks. Those banks were important because they had to have the cash to build, and what's more, the cash to buy those machines, the looms, the huge looms from the north that made so much of Greenville's textiles possible.
My next question is, are these New England investors or are these local folks putting up the money?
In the beginning, it's a mixed bag. American Spinning's owner, started George Sampson, had come here in 1873 to start Campertown Mill. He was a Yankee from Boston. He had some money because of an insurance thing. But Poe raised some money from the north because he knew some textile people there. He had been a traveling salesman. Mills didn't at all. Union Bleachery was funded in part, more than in part, actually, almost entirely, by James B. Duke and some of his friends from North Carolina. That was not Yankee money. It was that was definitely Duke and Duke's pals.
Okay. James B. Duke, we're talking about the tobacco magnet, right?
Yes, yes. James B. Duke, American Tobacco, electricity, light rail, and then, of course, Duke Power, which eventually owns Greenville's trolley system, as well as its dams.
So when he puts his money into textiles, he's not doing it just to be nice. He's doing it to make money. but so were locals like Woodside.
Yes, John T. Woodside was quite an extraordinary man. He had been an owner of a dry goods store, had some connections with the North, but set out one day in 1903 to raise $60,000 to go with what he already had. And after one thing or another, he had Woodside Mill going. And between 1904, when it opens, late 1903, and 1911, the company, the mill, expands dramatically. They buy mills in Fountain Inn and Simpsonville and Easley and expand. Finally, by 1911, Woodside Mill in Greenville is the largest mill under one cover in the nation, maybe the world. Anyway, it's huge. And it's, of course, its mill village was as large, 10 blocks at least.
And Woodside became, or he was a self-described as the richest man in the state.
Right, in 1916. And in 1930, he was bankrupt.
Okay, let's get him to there because he's an interesting story. Today, if you talk about Woodside, unless you know South Carolina history, you don't really – it's almost like the Magnificent Ambersons if you get back to English American literature. They were once famous and then in three generations, they're gone.
The four brothers led by John T., they ran everything.
And they built one of those big mansions, right?
They did, but – perhaps more to the point, they decided to build a hotel and a resort in a nowhere place in Horry County, which is became Myrtle Beach, and they lost all of that too. But that was, of course, at the Depression.
That hotel stood until the late 20th century, the Ocean Forest.
Ocean Forest, yes.
So we've got the textile world. By World War I, you've got Textile Hall, which becomes the biggest textile fair annually in the world, literally.
Biannually, but yes, and it's not just textiles. That was where Furman played its basketball games for many, many, many years. It was a kind of town, a new town center, and Greenville was so proud of being, as it named itself after the first textile exposition, the textile center of the South. And then it became the textile center of the world after the 1950s.
And that was not just hyperbole, it was true.
That was true, yes.
Yep, that was true.
But on the other hand, but in 1914, 1915, they were looking over their shoulders at Spartanburg real, real carefully.
And also, from being the center of the textile world, with competition from particularly Asian nations, cheaper imports. Greenville had to reinvent itself in the 1970s as textile mills closed down, and that's where we come to the story of Max Heller. He's one of those people from off, way off, and I think for our listeners outside the state, you might give us a brief bio of Max and what he did.
Extraordinary man. Max was 18 when he arrived in Greenville, a Jew from Vienna who was able to escape in 1938 after the Anschluss, only because he had met a young Greenville girl on her grand tour the previous year, and he had danced with her, and he had gotten her address. He didn't speak any much English at all, and she didn't speak for a whole lot of German, but his contact with Mary Mills was enough so that she went to a Jewish man named Salzman who owned a shirt factory downtown and asked him to give Max Heller, this boy that she had met in Vienna, a job. And he did, and Max came with like $6 in his pocket and immediately went to work. I mean, he arrived in Greenville at 10 and was at work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He was then able to bring his parents and then his fiancée to Greenville as well. He did very well. He went from being a sweeper to owning his own textile mill. And then eventually he retires. He was doing things in the public eye a good bit by the 1960s. And by 1972, they talk him into running for mayor of Greenville, and it was the best thing that could have happened to the place because he was able to work with the old guard who had already been concerned about Greenville. It wasn't new being aware that downtown was ugly, that it was dirty, that nobody would want to be there. That had been a problem for a good many years. What Max was able to do was to join with Tommy White, Buck Mickle, and some others, Alistair Furman, who were really concerned and were able to, well, let's face it, practically break arms enough to get $10 million locally. And Max had Democratic connections in Washington, and among them and between them, whatever, they were able to get the money to redo downtown Greenville with landscaping. Although they had tried this once before, at that point, this was about 15 years earlier, they slip-covered buildings with aluminum siding, some of the ugliest aluminum siding you've ever seen, Walter.
I love the term you call them. They slip covered downtown Greenville with aluminum siding to make the buildings look modern, and in the process they covered over some very wonderful late 19th and early 20th century brick storefronts.
Yep, it really did. And then they took down the really quite elegant hotel and built the Downtowner Motel, which really stood out for total ugliness. When I came to town in 76, I mean, honest to God, I thought it was an eyesore. It was modern. It had aluminum siding. But anyway, in this early 70s, you have this new impetus because of Max. When I came here in 76, I was so stunned by Greenville. I had reservations about moving to South Carolina. I really did. And not that North Carolina was that much better. That's where I'd been teaching. But I thought, ooh, South Carolina. And I had gotten my PhD at the University of Iowa. And my advisor was very hesitant about my going to South Carolina.
Well,
I found Max, a Jew, as the mayor, Pat Haskell Robinson, a woman, as mayor pro tem, and these people who were really concerned about a community. And I've also found really quite wonderful colleagues at Furman. It was a very interesting place in those years. But, you know, it wasn't all good. I mean, Greenville reinvented itself in the 70s. But there was also, because of I-85, which skimmed the outside of the city, because of I-85 and the ease of communication between Atlanta and Charlotte and the North, there was drugs and there was crime. By the time you have in the mid-70s, Greenville is third per capita in murders in this nation.
Hmm.
I mean, you don't think of it, you know? So there were, and then we got a really good sheriff, Johnny Mac Brown, and that did make things a whole lot better. And also several sheriff's deputies were indicted.
Earlier we talked about the mill villages, which surrounded these mills, literally housing thousands and thousands of people. But those mill villages houses were owned by the mills. And so...
Until... Really, they start going in the very late 40s. After J.P. Stevens comes in 47, Alistair Furman says, "When are you going to sell the mills?" And he said, Stevens said, "I'm not. We need control." They worked it out together real, real well. They had their own mortgage company, and they discovered that a owner on a mortgage was just as much concerned about jobs as a renter in a mill village house. And so they went. Furman Company had like 16 people who did nothing but mill village sell-offs all over from Delaware to Alabama. But by the 70s, what is really important is a complex. You really can't say because of one thing Greenville changed, but you have the complex of northern big multinational corporations coming in, GE first, with a gas turbine company, which was really quite marvelous for Greenville employment. And then you have Michelin, their only place outside of Clermont-Ferrand in France. They came in part because of Donaldson Center. And Donaldson Center had been Donaldson Air Force Base, the Army Air Force Base during World War II, and the Army had poured money into it. And when they decided to pour money out of it and move to Savannah, everything was left. And for once, Greenville City and Greenville County agreed on something. They don't generally. And they were able to buy it back, all the property back, and for, I can't remember, $200,000+. And they immediately sold off electricity and a couple of the other things there, which took care of all of that. But having that facility with its airstrips that were the longest in South Carolina, which provided really terrific transportation outside, and a place where they would have all of the facilities they needed, brought a good many industries to South Carolina. So you have, although the mills start closing, as you say, because of offshore imports and lower prices and so on, because of that, there is a place where workers can find jobs, usually at higher salaries, better salaries, and then you toss in Greenville Tech, which really made a difference because they could prepare people for specific work, which made it very, very attractive. As, of course, did Greenville's entirely anti-union atmosphere, and it's basically, in terms of the nation, quite low salaries, and cheap land, and lots of water.
Well, see, I think it's interesting that we're talking about the Donaldson, again, a specific part of Greenville. At this point, they're not redoing the old abandoned mills. That's going to come when we start dealing with 20th Century Wonder, which is the concluding chapter. So let's talk about it. Began with Max Heller, it's continued with Mayor White. Let's talk about that transition, because converting textile mills or old manufacturing facilities in the late 20th and early 21st century became kind of a chic thing to do in towns. First, you know, it's pretty cheap. You can turn it into an artist community. You can turn it into apartments, you know.
Lofts. Always the wonder of lofts. You put a loft on something and you immediately raise the price $50 a month.
Okay. All right. And you've got lots of those abandoned.
Oh, we do. We have lofts, yes.
But you also discover the river, and that's not an easy thing. You've got that darn bridge that covers everything up, right?
Right. Until finally they have the guts to do it. And this is one of the things that I really give Knox credit for.
Now we're talking about Knox White.
Knox White.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Knox White, yeah. We're old pals. But that coming down of that Camperdown Bridge opened up the whole river, particularly the side that the Greenville Garden Clubs, those garden clubs were marvelous. What they did in terms of the landscaping all the way down the south side, south bank of the river was quite extraordinary. And you know, Walter, one of the things we didn't mention, I'm not sure just how it works, but Furman had been in downtown Greenville for 100 years before it moved in the 1950s away. But leaving that land above the Reedy River and it becoming eventually the home of the South Carolina Governor's School of the Arts and Humanities was another one of those things that added to Greenville's charisma. I don't know whether you can talk about a charismatic city, but
well,
it is.
It certainly has become in the 21st century, but as I mentioned earlier, well into the 1970s, it weren't so. But today, Greenville is on the top 10 list of this, or the top 10 list of that. I was stunned when I had friends in Atlanta say, oh, we're coming to spend the weekend in Greenville. I said, Greenville, South Carolina? What on earth are you going to do? And they talk about their foodies, all of these restaurants. She is an artist. She said, you've got a tremendous art community. I said, I know about Charleston. She said, you better rediscover Greenville, because Greenville is the place to go to.
It is. Sometimes, I mean, the Peace Center opened in 1996. Peace Center, major funding for it, for the buildings, a complex by the Reedy River, which includes a 2,000 or so seat auditorium and then a 400 or 500 seat auditorium, a 1857 textile mill, a 1884 textile mill, both of which have been brilliantly redone, and a kind of open, well, it's a building that doesn't have windows, but it has its basic outline still. It had been a paint shop in 1904, but it's a place where meetings are held. Suddenly it becomes, instead of an ugly, ugly parking lot with trailers and piled up pieces of concrete overlooking a sludgy river, which is what it was when my husband and I married in one of those buildings in 1985. By 2000, the river was clean and clear, not as clean and clear as it is today, but clean, much cleaner than it had been. And the whole place had been landscaped, redone. The Huguenot Mill, the three-story mill, become a really extraordinarily beautiful office sort of complex with all sorts of rooms for meeting and so on. The whole place had become beautiful, and people responded. And then the west end of Greenville, which was after Furman's leaving, had gone downhill. It was tawdry. There were admittedly prostitutes on corners. There was some drug stuff. And all of that over the years, but really starting in the late 90s, but really taking off in the beginning of the 21st century, that changed. It became a center. There are people strolling the streets at night. There were all of these restaurants and cool places, boutique.
Yeah, the West End is derelict. What turned it around?
It was a public-private partnership. The public part was certainly the donation of two turn-of-the-century buildings that became at first a public market and now have a variety of businesses and restaurants in it. The city invested big time. Duke Power buried its power lines. The city completely redid the roads.
Sounds like there were a lot of partners coming together.
Every time the Greenville has changed and grown, it's been both the public and the private. At first, a lot more public. But after Max Heller, the city really took on a role of supporting anything downtown.
Mayor Bill Workman comes in there after Max Heller.
Yes, he was, and I should have mentioned Bill. Although I never forgave him for being in favor of keeping the bridge over the river. But he did a lot of good things beside that.
The private-public part, I think you mentioned some of the private, but the city of Greenville and the county of Greenville don't always get along. And,
that is pretty mildly, yes.
Yes. So much of this has to do with civic pride by Greenvillians, native and adopted, in making their city what it is today.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
Because you can create, oh, we're going to have these lofts for artists, but if people don't move in there, if people don't patronize the artists or the restaurants, it's not going to succeed.
But, you know, so much of that came because downtown was attractive, and there was a reason to stroll, and there were benches to sit on, and trees overhead, and little bitty lights in the trees, and you had the Hyatt coming. That this is in the 70s. Well, it opened in 81, actually. But you have this sense of a place that it's pleasant to be. And even now, I mean, driving downtown at night is very difficult because there are so many pedestrians on the streets. Walking dogs, with children, couples. I don't understand it deeply. I think we got awfully lucky.
Well,
but and also, it was planning.
Well, you mentioned one historic hotel that was torn down, but there was one that was...
One that didn't get torn down, thank heaven, coming back. Yeah. When the Points Hotel came, it was a retirement place for a while. Then it was condemned. There were people sleeping in it at night who were homeless. And then the same guy who did Steve Dopp, who did the Francis Marion in Charleston, looked at Greenville and poured money into redoing the Poinsett. And when that opened, and at this point, I can't remember exactly when early, but about 20 years ago, it was a marvelous night. Red carpet all the way. And now it is just one of the things that Greenville is most proud of. And, you know, talking about the points, it reminds me of that right next door, you have the old county courthouse, which had become the family court, which was sort of falling to pieces. And then M. Judson Bookstore came in, and the whole place again is alive and well. Across the street, there are restaurants. in a building that was probably constructed about 1885. You have two little restaurants now and some condos. Even the things that came later in the 30s, well, not many things came in the 30s, but in the late 20s, they have been redone. Neighborhoods that were once pretty questionable have come back roaring as Greenville discovered its history.
Okay. Alfred is giving us the wind-up sign, as he's done for a quarter of a century with the Journal. Judy Bainbridge, author of A Short History of Greenville, thank you so much for being with us today on the Journal.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Walter.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. It was a pleasure talking with Judith Bainbridge again. Her book, A Short History of Greenville, tells the story of Greenville, South Carolina, from the economic boom brought by the textile industry to the bust of the Great Depression, and finally to the revitalization of the downtown as a haven for business and tourism in the 21st century. And she tells this story in a lively style.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month, and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.